Morning, everyone. Happy Sabbath. It's good to be here, isn't it? Oh, boy. You wait all week just to be here. And it goes too fast. 10 to 12 already. I can't believe it. But we're not in a rush today, are we? We're resting today, aren't we? Let those pressures, the peer pressures we talked about in Sabbath school, roll off your shoulders, let those cares roll away, and just look to Jesus today. That's what we're here for. Now, the more astute among you may have guessed that there's a theme to my sermon today. Love. That's amazing. How did you pick that up? Love, Aldous Huxley declares, is overdone. It's passé. It's a word that's been used and abused more than any other word in the English language. The human longing for love is celebrated in song and in story. But I've got this feeling that in our culture, that desire for love has been magnified, commodified, and sold to a lonely, willing audience. The music industry is based on love songs. Just about any song you know is going to have the word love in it. Mills and Boone books, who remembers those books? You ever seen those? They publish 100 books per month. That's 3 love books a day. That's incredible, isn't it? And you know what? They wouldn't be printing them if they weren't selling them. Think about the most popular movies that we have in current culture, and they're to do with love. Titanic. The teens love the Twilight films. Some of them anyway. It's always about love. And these songs, these books, these movies paint an unrealistic picture of love. And I think it's killing our culture. I think it's killing our kids in particular. They're selling this idealized version and we have bought it. And as a consequence, I think we've turned love itself into an idol, something we worship. I mean, I would rather look at the Bible to tell me about love, because I think we've got it mixed up. In English, we have one word for love. You say, I love you, and that's what you declare to the one who means the world to us, one who is our soulmate, one who is the other half of us made flesh. And that's wonderful. There's nothing wrong with feeling loved or loving someone, and many would agree that love is, in fact, the pinnacle of human experience, at least it should be. To know and to be known and be fully accepted and cared for and loved. You can have all the money in the world, but if you're not loved, it's worth nothing. But at the same time, we might say, gee, I love ice cream. Okay. Does that mean you want to make a lifetime commitment to ice cream? Does that mean that ice cream is your soulmate? Some people may be putting their hands up at this point. Of course not. If someone says that they love you, further definition is needed. And you've probably heard about the different words for love in Greek. There's different words. Agape love, phileo love, a brotherly love, a storge love, which is like a family love, and there's eros love as well. We've restricted that in our culture, don't we? We only say I love you in a romantic context. Can you imagine it? Two burly blokes just finishing their work for the day, take off their high-vis vests, hang up their hard hats, see you tomorrow, love ya. Wouldn't happen, right? Not without a few drinks under the belt. We are repressive of love in our society. That means it's an unhealthy view of love that we have. And I want a healthy view of love. And so we're going to look at one of the most cliched verses about love that you can imagine. Who's going to guess where we're going? There's a few guesses. We're going to 1 Corinthians 13. I can even hear you groaning, oh, that one, right? Don't tell me he's preaching about that one. Even in our churches, love has become passé and overdone. But I'd like to have a little bit of a fresh look at it today. Because I think it's the one thing that sets us apart, that defines us for who we are. And not this fake love that's out there, not this idol love that people worship and want and desire in the way that they should desire God, but a real love. And I think 1 Corinthians has it. 1 Corinthians 13, you know, you've probably heard about it before because you've been to a wedding, right? And in weddings, this is one of the most favourite chapters to read out because it talks about a high view of love. And it does, and it's a beautiful verse, and the chapter itself is fantastic. But I guess I wanted to read it today with the view that Paul is not talking to a couple about to be married. He's not talking about marriage at all. Do you know who he's talking about? The church. In the previous chapter, he's talked about the gifts that can be given to the church body. He's talked about, as we looked in our Sabbath school last week, the church as one body made of many parts. And so he's talking about the love in that context. And if you've got the kind of Bible that I do, you can see that chapter 13 is split up into three paragraphs and one sentence at the end. There's a reason for that. Let's have a look at it. 1 Corinthians 13, verses 1 to 3. If I speak in the tongues of men or of angels, but do not have love, I am only a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have the gift of prophecy and can fathom all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have a faith that can move mountains but do not have love, I am nothing. If I give all I possess to the poor and give over my body to hardship that I may boast but do not have love, I gain nothing. The first thing you should notice is the pattern that he's using here. It's a call and response, right? You've got to notice this stuff in the Bible when you read it. It's there for a reason. It's poetry that Paul's writing here. If I do this, I'm only this. If I have this, I have nothing. If I give all, I am nothing. Can you see the pattern there? That's pure poetry that Paul has written here. It's beautiful. The other thing I want to point out before we read into it is a word, hyperbole. Who's heard of hyperbole? Thank you, Joan. Hyperbole is exaggeration for effect. I've told you a million times, don't touch it. Right? Of course you didn't tell them a million times. You're exaggerating to get the point through that you've told them a lot of times. Okay? And what Paul uses here in the first three verses is hyperbole. Some people have read this first verse and said, see, Paul talks in the tongues of angels. Proved right there. No, Paul is using hyperbole. He's saying, if I speak in the tongues of men, you can imagine him speaking grandiosely, can't you? If I speak in the tongues of men or angels, you know, this grand picture. Look at the first things, right? This picture that he's painting of this perfect Christian. If I have the gift of prophecy and can fathom all mysteries, right? That's hyperbole. Is anyone really like that? If I have faith that can move mountains. Okay, he's using hyperbole. If I give all I possess and give my body to hardship, or your version might say to be burned. If I give all of my possessions and even my life. He's using hyperbole, okay? He's not saying go burn your body. He's not saying that he speaks in some heavenly language. He's using this high picture of this idealized person with a picture of someone without love, who is nothing. Are you with me so far? You didn't know you were going to get an English lesson when you came here this morning. But you've got to understand the Bible, right? This is what he's saying. These are the tools he's using. We have to understand it. Now, he's just talked about spiritual gifts, so maybe he's talking about the gift of tongues, speaking in other languages so that people can understand, as we see happen in the book of Acts. But there's another thing that I found quite interesting in my research. Gongs and cymbals and odd tones of voices are actually used in pagan worship, in particular in Corinth. And just to name one of them, I'm going to talk about Dionysus. Have you heard of Dionysus? Right? One of these pagan gods. Dionysus was worshipped in Corinth from at least 150 years before the time of Jesus. And a part of their worship involved crying out. I cut this from a book by Hoyle about the nature of the worship of Dionysus. This is what he says. They follow torches as they dip and sway in the darkness. They're dancing here. They climbed mountain paths with head thrown back and eyes glazed, dancing to the beat of the drum which stirred their blood. In the state of ecstasy, they abandoned themselves, dancing wildly and calling out, Enoi, which means wine, because he's the god of wine. At that moment of intense rapture, they become identified with the God himself. They become filled with his spirit and acquire divine powers. This is what they believe. They used instruments to produce that ecstatic condition and emotional intoxication. A resounding gong. Strange voices. So people in Corinth get what he's talking about. He's kind of saying, you can go and do all those things that those pagan worshippers do. You can, you know, cry out loud and you can speak in weird tongues, but without love, you've got nothing. And these people didn't have love. There's a difference that he's pointing out between pagan worshippers and the followers of Christ. And that difference is love. No matter how much you work yourselves into a lather, how loudly they proclaimed, if there's no love, then that noise is as empty as the pagan worship they know is empty, because they're not worshipping a god, but themselves. Now, they know about the gongs because they're from Corinth, and Corinth made bronzes. But what's interesting is this clanging symbol in Greek, the word clanging, is alalazo. And if, I don't know if you can hear it. Here's another word, onomatopoeia. Who knows onomatopoeia? Taking you back to school now. That's a sound word. Bang, crash, right? Alalazo is one of those. It's an onomatopoeic word. Alalalalalalalalalalalala. Can you hear what he's saying? This is how they're talking in this pagan worship. Sound familiar? Alalalalalalalalalala, right? The difference, though, between those pagan worshippers and Christians is love. That's how we show that we're a follower of Christ, is love. You know, even in verse 2, it says, if I have the gift of prophecy and can fathom all mysteries. And prophecy in the Old Testament is usually talking about a prediction pointing towards Jesus. In the New Testament, it's used in that context, but also in the context of a sermon, really. That's another word that they use for a sermon. It's a speech that's come from divine inspiration to declare the purpose of God. That's what a sermon should be. So he's saying, even if you use a gift, a spiritual gift in the church, and if you understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and even if you have as much faith that you can move a mountain but have not love, or nothing. You might think, well, how is it possible to have a spiritual gift and not have love? Is it possible to have a spiritual gift and not have love? Think about Samson. He got given a gift, didn't he? Did he use it for love? The wrong kind, right? Absolutely, it's possible to do that. Is it possible to understand all mysteries and have all doctrinal knowledge and yet not have love? Is it possible to intellectually understand and accept all the doctrines of the Seventh-day Adventist Church and yet not be a Christian? Because you don't have love. You bet it is. Love's the deciding factor, not knowledge. Even faith, it says. You can have faith that can move mountains. You can believe as hard or as strong as anyone on earth, but if you don't have love, there's no purpose to it. And verse 3, if I give all I possess to the poor. Some Bibles have the boasting section and some don't. It's because the Greek is a little challenging there. That's why there's some different kind of language. But would someone even die for anything but love. I thought, surely no one would die for anything but love. That's why I would die for someone, if I love them. And then I thought for a while, and I thought, of course, people might die for anger, right? People might die for spite, even in a religious context. Aren't we seeing this overseas right now? Plenty of people willing to die for a religious purpose out of anger, right? Not out of love, out of hate. So even martyring yourself won't help unless you have love. Paul talks about religious actions in each of three of these verses, doesn't he? Proclaiming in a dynamic voice, prophesying, having all knowledge and faith, giving all you possess to the poor. He's talking about religious activities. And his main point is that all religious activity is meaningless without love as its foundation. From the smallest potluck in a rural church to the biggest Amazing Facts evangelistic campaign, all of it is pointless unless you come from a place of love. Unless the foundation is love. There's no point being here in this church today if you're not here motivated by love. You won't get anything from it. I hope that you stay. I think Corinthians here gives us this picture of love that is beyond what we think. I think we've bought into the cultural ideas of love. No, the Bible puts it much higher. Let's have a look at the next section. Because now you might say, what is love? And that's hard to answer. If you ask, 10 people what is love, you'll get 12 answers. Because how do you define love? It's difficult, but Paul does it really well. He describes its other qualities. Love is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy. It does not boast. It is not proud. It is not rude. It is not self-seeking. It is not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. I don't know about you, but I think that's one of the most beautiful sections of the Bible. Paul clearly lays out what love is so that anyone reading it can understand. That is love. That's exactly my experience of love. The picture of love that Paul presents is the best picture of love. And I'll tell you what, when I hold my own love up against this picture, when I think, say, about my love that I have for my wife even, it is sad and pathetic compared to this picture of love that Paul holds up. Have I been easily angered in my marriage? Yes. Have I held an account of wrongs so later on I can go, ha ha! Yes. Have I been envious and boastful and proud? Yes, all those things. It's a sad, small love that does that. And I think God has given us this picture of love so we can see what love should be. The first two words, patient and kind, in fact, Paul uses in Romans to describe the very character of God. And there's similarities, isn't there? We know that 1 John 4:8 tells us that God is love. We're not told that God has love or God is loving. We're told that he is the embodiment of love. And one pastor I talked to once said this, that any feeling of love that you have for another person, any true love, not just selfish love, any real idea or feeling or impulse of love that you have originated with God. Because there is no love without God. You must have God to know love. The Bible says, if you know God, then you know love. If you do not know God, you do not know love. It's not always easy to have that kind of love in a church, let alone in a marriage. There's a couple who'd been married only a few weeks when he came home from work and found his wife in tears. What's wrong, he said. sure that he'd done something that she was about to punish him for. "The dog ate the meal I cooked for you," she sobbed. And relieved, he said, "That's okay, we can get another dog." Right? Love is not always easy to match up to these ideals in Corinthians. And Paul's not only talking about marriages, he's talking about the love that we should have between you and me, between each other, between the person sitting next to you here in this room. This is the kind of love he's pointing us to for each other. That's tough. How do you love someone when you probably don't even like them? But I think our expectations of love are mixed up. I think that's the problem. Love's so devalued it's turned into a reality game show. You know how many game shows there are about love? Boy, I looked it up, and there are too many. I mean, I remember Perfect Match from the 80s. Who remembers Perfect Match? Maybe some of you have been good at Venice all your life and never watched the dating show. You're not missing out on a thing. Perfect Match had a little robot called Dexter. One guy and three girls behind a wall, and he'd ask questions and they would answer them and they would go on a date at the end of it. If that wasn't bad enough, it's only gotten worse since then. Farmer Wants a Wife, who's heard of that one? We've had 9 seasons of that in Australia. It's about women competing to marry a farmer. It's a game show, right? What is love? It's just a game show. The Bachelor really revolutionised it, you know. One man, 20 girls, and he gets to choose at the end of them and give them flowers as though that signifies a real love. What about there's the latest one that's been out, Married at First Sight. Have you heard of that one? Where they do arranged marriages on television. The first time they meet each other is at the live televised wedding. Boy, is that going to turn out well? Married at First Sight. It's crazy, isn't it? Joe Millionaire. They did a bachelor kind of situation and told this girl, all these 20 girls, that this one guy was a millionaire. Guess what? He wasn't. He was a brickie. Right? They're tricking these women for amusement. That's what love is. The last one I found, I couldn't even believe this was real. The conveyor belt of love. Where 5 women sit in front of a conveyor belt that 30 men are trundled across one by one. And they hold up a sign saying yes or no. This is their picture of love that we have today. It's very different from this verse, isn't it? That's not love, what they're experiencing. But I want to suggest this thing, that God has given us love for a reason. That love is still good. That real love is still worth having and fighting for. And for everyone, not just for the married people. For everyone in our family here. I want to challenge you with something, I guess, before I go on. I want you to, this week, tell someone that you love them, that you've never told that before. Make sure it's someone that you actually do love. That would be preferable, okay? But I want you to think about that. Even as I've challenged you with that, have you gone, "Oh, I don't want to do that. That's uncomfortable. That's scary." It's not. It's not. But that's my challenge for you. And you know what? It's not really even a challenge. It's a command, isn't it? John 13:34, "A new commandment I give you, love one another as I have loved you. So you must love one another. By this everyone will know that you are my disciples, if you love one another." That's to be the defining characteristic of our church, is love. That's how we're supposed to be. I was talking with a guy in Ararat who came to do Sabbath school. He said, "We're peculiar because of our diet. We're peculiar because of our mode of dress." Maybe. But I want to be peculiar for the amount of love that we have for each other. I want to be a peculiar people because of that. Because it's not in the world. That kind of love doesn't exist. But you know what? People want it. People are searching for it. That's why they have these game shows. And we have it. And we have it on offer. What a tragedy if we don't give it out. If we don't show them what we've got. For Paul, love is not just an action. It's not just a doing thing, it's a state of mind. It's a way of living. It's what motivates each of our actions. The last section here, 1 Corinthians 13 from verse 8, says, love never fails, but where there are prophecies, they will cease. Where there are tongues, they will be stilled. Where there is knowledge, it will pass away. For we know in part and we prophesy in part. But when perfection comes, the imperfect disappears. When I was a child, I talked like a child, I thought like a child, I reasoned like a child. When I became a man, I put childish ways behind me. Now we see but a poor reflection, then we shall see face to face. Now I know in part, then I shall know fully, even as I am fully known. Can you see the poetry once again in those writings? I love the way Paul writes. He's a master of rhetoric. And it's astonishing what he says. Where there are prophecies, they will cease. And we know that to be true, don't we? We know, we understand a lot about prophecies. But there's going to come a time when we pass the end of all prophecies that we have in the Word. Prophecies will cease. And what will the value of our knowledge of prophecy be then? Prophecies will end. Where there are tongues, they will be stilled. People preach the Word of God, people talk to each other. But at the end of the talking, what's the reality of the situation? My wife says to me, you know, you can talk all you like, you've got to show me. Tongues will be stilled. Will love remain? Where there is knowledge, it will pass away. Knowledge itself is not going to last forever. These things, prophecies and tongues and knowledge, we think are so sturdy and such a foundation for us. All of those things, Paul says, will be stilled, will pass away. For we know in part and we prophesy in part. We don't have it all, do we? We know in part. We only know part of it. We don't have all knowledge. We prophesy in part. We don't have all knowledge of prophecy. We don't have complete knowledge of God. We're going to, he says. It's going to happen. When I was a child, I talked like a child and I thought like a child. You know, when I think about Eliana's love that she has for us, and she loves her parents. Kids love their mums and dads. It's like some of those things that he said. It's envious. When I give my wife a cuddle, she rushes up to us to get in the way, right? No, no, hug me, hug me. It's boastful. She wants to boast about who loves her best and she tries to play us off against each other, right? It's a childish love, isn't it? You know what? Sadly, that's the kind of love that a lot of adults have. This kind of childish love. Self-seeking. I'll love you as long as you love me. I'll love you if it suits me. It keeps record of wrongs. Of course it does. Selfish love. Daddy, but you said this and this and this, Eliana will say. But then adults do just the same thing, right? You said this and this and this, and they hold it against their spouse. That's not love, Paul says. Can you imagine living in a marriage, those of you who've been married, where the other person never held an account of your wrongs, ever? Boy, I would like that. Wouldn't that be amazing? And I think if we're honest, sometimes our love is like that towards God sometimes too. We're selfish about God's love. We don't share it. It's self-seeking. We get easily angered at God when things are difficult. We keep a record of where God has let us down. God, why didn't you do this for me? I prayed about this, God. Why didn't you do this? Paul's saying we're like children the way that we love. But it won't always be that way. Because right now we see a poor reflection, but then we'll see face to face. And pay attention in verse 12. Now I know in part, then I shall know fully. We talked about the now and the not yet in Sabbath school. But he says, even as I am fully known. He is already fully known by who? God. God fully knows him. God fully knows us. We don't fully know God. We only know in part. But one day we'll see God face to face. You know, there are times when life gets tough, when it's a struggle, when we fear, when we lose people that we care about. And when those moments happen, I come back to verse 8, where it says, love never fails. Everything else can fail, but love will not fail. And I think that's fascinating, because when you sit down next to someone who's just lost someone, if someone dies, coming with scripture feels empty because they're hurting so much. Coming with prophecy doesn't help. Coming with knowledge is no good. But love never fails. If you come with love, that's the best way we can show people God. God is love. The impulse of our love begins with God. When my daughter shows me love, when she spontaneously hugs me, I know that's from God too. That impulse has come from Him. Love never fails. And when she asked me about someone that died in our family, I said, love never fails. Love doesn't die. If we have a love that originates with God, then that love lasts forever with Him. This is why Paul says in verse 13, and now these three remain, faith, hope, and love. But the greatest of these is love. And I thought, that's challenging. And then I thought about it. Faith without love is cold. You can have a faith without love, but it is a cold faith if you don't love. You can have hope without love, but it is grim. Because love is what your hope is based on. If it's not based on love, than is based on desperation. We need both faith and hope, but without love, we can't have either. There was a comparative religious conference. The wise and the scholarly were having a spirited debate about what's unique about Christianity. Someone suggested that what set Christianity apart from other religions was the concept of incarnation. The idea that God took human form in Jesus. But someone quickly said, well, actually, other faiths believe that God appears in human form as well. Another suggestion was offered, what about resurrection? The belief that death is not the final word, that the tomb was found empty. Someone slowly shook his head. Other religions have accounts of other people returning from the dead. Maybe that doesn't make us completely unique. Then, as the story is told, C.S. Lewis wanders into the room with his tweed jacket and his pipe, his arm full of papers. He was going to give a presentation. He was a little early. And he sat down and listened to them for a while. And finally, during a lull, he spoke, saying, what's all this about? What's all this rumpus going on about? And they turned his direction and they said, we're debating what's unique about Christianity. And he said, that's easy. It's grace. The room fell silent. Lewis continued that Christianity uniquely claims that God's love comes free of charge. No strings attached. No other religion makes that claim. After a moment, someone said that he might have a point. Buddhism, for example, Buddhists follow an eightfold path to enlightenment. It's not a free ride. You've got to follow a path to get there. Hindus believe in karma, that your actions continually affect you. That nothing comes to you that you have not set in motion by your actions. Someone observed that the Jewish code of law implies that God has requirements for people to be acceptable to Him. And in Islam, God is a God of judgment and not a God of love. Your life in Islam is to appease God. And at the end of the discussion, everyone concluded that Lewis had a point. Only Christianity dares to proclaim God's love is unconditional, an unconditional love that we call grace. This is the kind of love that Paul's describing here in Corinthians. The love that God has for us. And I guess that's our foundation. That love should be our lesson. The way that Jesus loved His disciples is how we should love each other. And I hope it's your prayer today, and it's my prayer today, that I learn to love better than I have. That I learn to love each person here better than I have. Who would like that? Who would like to be in a place where that love exists? I would too. Father, thank You for this picture of love that you've given us. Lord, sometimes our love does not compare to yours. So I pray that you help us to see the love that Jesus had for his disciples. You let that love touch our hearts, that Jesus can dwell in our hearts, and so through us that love can be shown to others. Help us to put aside all bitterness, envy and strife, and look only to love each other as best as we can. And I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.